Welcome to My Shit Therapist, the podcast in which I, Michelle Thomas, ask people what is the best and worst thing a therapist has ever said to them. And boy, oh boy, have I heard some stories. Hello, it's been a minute. How are you doing? It's the hottest day of the year here in Bristol in the UK, which is why I'm naturally in a dark room with the curtains closed recording this. I've been quiet for a couple of months. I'd love doing this podcast and I'm going to keep doing it for as long as I can. And I work full time and I'm planning to write another book, which is a follow up to My Shit Therapist and Other Mental Health Stories, the bestseller. Thank you. And doing all the things all the time during, you know, an apocalypse is, I'm sure you know, a lot. I think the received wisdom about doing anything creative is that you have to do all the things all the time to the strictest possible standard. Be consistent, be brilliant, be slick. And that just doesn't work for me, I'm afraid, every time. So I'm pretty sure I've mentioned The Artist's Way on this podcast several times before. It's a 12-week workshop for creativity, and this is the third year in a row that I've done it. I love it, and I want to read a bit to you that's resonated with me recently. In a twisted version of Darwinian determinism, we tell ourselves that real artists can survive the most hostile environments and yet find their true calling like homing pigeons. That's hogwash. Many real artists bear children too early or have too many, are too poor or too far removed culturally or monetarily from artistic opportunity to become the artists they really are. These artists, shadow artists through no fault of their own, hear the distant piping of the dream, but are unable to find their way through the cultural maze to find it. So if you're an artist if you're a creative person who has been less creative over the last 6 months or 12 months or 18 months, and you're giving yourself a hard time about that, pack that in, mate. Be gentle with yourself. Be nice for yourself. And when you do come back to it, because you will come back to it, you know you will. This is who you are. This is what you do. When you do come back to it, and you do start creating again, be gentle with it and share it. Because the alternative is that we only consume content by people who have the means to follow a particular set of rules and a particular format. And who wants to listen to those pricks? Not me. I'm desperate to be one of those pricks. Those grapes are sour. So I gave myself a break and I've made some adjustments, and now I'll be releasing a new episode of My Shit Therapist every month. And I'm really excited about some of the sexy stuff I've got lined up for you over the next year. All right, let's get into it. For this episode, I spoke with the luminescent author, Caroline O'Donoghue. Caroline is the author of Scenes of a Graphic Nature, which is a beautiful, dark, stormy jewel of a book that I loved last summer. Caroline talked about her on and off relationship with talking therapy, why Freud and Jung are like the Jets and the Sharks, sexy 70s names, books, tarot, Catholicism, and coping with grief. I love her, and I think you're going to love this. All right, let's do it.
Sorry, this is a weird way to like say,
no,
hi.
I love
Hello,
it.
I'm Caroline.
Hi, thank you so much for agreeing to talk to me. I'm so pleased. And
thank you so much for agreeing to talk to me.
I love Scenes of a Graphic Nature. So much. I love your similes. I love your metaphors. And I like the first page where you talked about something being as joyful and compact as a grape. I was like, she's my friend. I want to be her friend.
My friend. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's so rare that generally when someone says, I love your book, they're just like, I love your book. I love the pages. and then they're like done with it. But no one ever really comes in with that specific, I love this simile. So it's very nice. Thank you. I've got a wine on the go.
Fantastic. I quit drinking last year, actually. I did dry January, and then I was like, oh, actually, this is quite nice, and I don't feel sad and panicky.
Oh, no. Yeah, I can definitely see that. There's definitely, I think it's different for everyone, but generally at some point in your 30s, you hit this point where you're like, oh, the juice is not worth the squeeze anymore when it comes to drink.
The juice is not worth the squeeze.
Yeah.
I love that.
Like, I'm anxious all the time. I can't sleep and I sweat all the time. I guess I'll keep drinking.
I was talking to Kate Lucy about it, actually. She's another author, and she said, she was talking to someone about it, and this guy just went, I've got enough stories. I've got enough stories about being like,
that's a really good way of putting it. Yeah.
And I'm just like, actually. And with all the stuff that's going on, I finally twigged that if I'm on antidepressants, I probably shouldn't eat a depressant to cancel it out. So it only took me like 5 years to work that one out. So I'm pretty pleased. I might start telling people. Caroline O'Donoghue, what is the best and worst thing a therapist has ever said to you?
Oh my God, how long is the answer allowed to be? Is this like the icebreaker question? But like, or is this the whole podcast? Because I have a story to tell you, Michelle. To sum up, to put the headline at the beginning of the story, I would think the worst thing a therapist has ever told me is when she made explicit reference to my body, and in particular my breasts, and then told me about her threesome that she had with her husband, and then went on to explain how it did nothing to save their marriage.
Oh, I'm really glad. It sounds like you got your money's worth. Like,
yeah, do you know what? This is it. This is it, mate. This is it. So I my first time I ever went to a therapist was in 2018.
Mm.
And the reason I did that was because I'd had a very rough sort of 9 months in that I had two people very close to me die. And my first book was coming out, and I had this, like, this happens quite frequently with me, this sort of thing of like extreme sadness and extreme excitement, but you know when excitement sort of verges on anxiety, because you feel like you're being looked at, and you feel like there's expectations, and you don't quite know how to manage them, and I found myself just having frequent like moments, very small moments of being like, this is you need to escalate this to upper management, because you cannot handle this project alone anymore.
Amazing.
But I was still kind of in this thing of like, I can't just have a normal therapist. I'm going to have a fun therapist. I'm going to find a cool mom, you know? And so I didn't really reach out to anyone. I didn't talk to many of my many friends who were already in therapy and ask them their advice on what is the best way to find a therapist. Cause I was still in the kind of like, no, I can fix this myself. So I went on one of those like therapy directories, and like, I just was kind of spinning through, and there were so many people, and they all, like, unless you have a very specific thing, like they're all dealing with anxiety and depression and all on the main guys, you know, the main people. And so I was just like, I saw this woman, she on her photo, she looked like fun. And she went to this university in Germany that one of my good friends also went to. And my immediate thought was like, oh, that'll be a good icebreaker, which is like not how you should think about. You should not be approaching a therapist as if you're approaching a Tinder date or something, you know. Yeah. But that was how I approached it, and what I didn't see, because I didn't know how to recognize these things, was that she was a Jungian therapist.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know anything about all that stuff? Are you quite versed? You know,
this is the kind of like square shaped information that does not fit into the star shaped holes in my brain. Like, I know that I've read it. I know that I've seen those words written down, but it just like,
I love that explanation for not retaining information.
It comes into my brain and then it just falls away. And it's not that I don't want to know, but no. So is he? Which one's he? Family dynamics.
Okay, yes. So yes, I think you're right. I think so obviously there's Freud,
Big
the big
one, yeah,
lad.
sexy lad. Everything
Big boy
sexy.
Freud. Everything sexy, everything is sex. Everything is you want a dick or you want to kill your dad, right? That's him.
Yeah.
And then his mate was young and he's all about dreams
Yeah.
and things. Basically, I don't really know. But I think when you're dealing with people who are working at that level, all I remember as well is that I know in Frasier, it was very important that Frasier was a Freudian therapist and Niles was a Jungian therapist, and that was supposed to be the great divide. But like, I think even when you're working with people at that level, when you're quite like when you're not like a 1970s intellectual, which I'm not. Getting involved with people who are that high-minded and going into therapy with this big theory that they're kind of trying to prove or disprove, and I'm sure this is useful for a lot of people, but for me, I went in and I was like, I sat on her couch and I was like, you know, here are the very specific issues I'm having right now. Here's my thing with my friend. Here's my thing with my job. And like, you know, here's the sort of very specific responses I'm having. And she was like, yeah, I think you need to start a dream journal. And I was like, I don't think I need to start a dream journal. I'm already a professional writer. I don't really need more homework, you know, because I don't know about you, but whenever a therapist assigns me writing tasks, I'm always like, well, are you going to give me a per word rate? You know, like this is literally my job. And when I try and do the assignment as well, I'm always a bit like editorializing and trying to make it like really
Nice,
good.
yeah.
And so I went to her for about six sessions, and I remember I would like open up and I would start talking about stuff and doing what I thought you were supposed to do in therapy. And one day she looked at me and she was like, you know, I've noticed in our session, sorry, this accent is offensive
I
and I
love it.
apologize for it, but there's really no way of capturing the mood of this woman without doing the voice. So she's like, so I've noticed in our sessions, you're a very beautiful woman. And I was like, thank you, Carla. That's very nice. And she was like, have you always been there this developed? I noticed you're very your breasts are
No,
very
no.
large. No, wrong.
Don't like that.
And I said to her, you know, actually, and here's me. This is like literally my first rodeo. So I'm like, maybe this is normal for your therapist to notice inappropriate things about you.
Your breasts are
And
too big, and that's why your friends hate
that's what
you.
they're all
They're all
jealous.
jealous of your breasts,
They're
Caroline.
all jealous. I'm heaving bazookas. And I was like, now that you mention it, I was kind of a late bloomer. I was like quite fat chested until I was 17. And then she really went after this and she was asking about like my parents' sex life and like all this kind of stuff. And I was like, I really am here for sort of grief counseling. This is not it, baby. And she asked me a lot about my relationship, which I said was very healthy. And then she thought I was deflecting. And then she was like, you know, when I was married to my first husband, he was Irish also. We had a threesome because I was quite curious, but it did not fix the marriage.
Keep it in your pants, Carla.
Carla, come
It's
on.
not the place. It's not the time. I'd probably have to edit her name because I can't imagine there are many
No,
German
I've
therapists called
consciously.
Carla.
I've consciously changed her name,
Ah,
but it's a name like that.
a sneaky writer's trick. I see you.
It's
Exchanging
one of
one word
those,
for another.
it's like a sexy 70s name, you know?
Oh my God, Donna.
Yeah, Barbara.
Amazing. Oh wow.
That was Carla.
Hi, Carla. And that's your first ever experience of therapy.
Yeah, that was the first one of two runs. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I tried again a few years later, and that was more successful. But I started to realize that even though I had a positive experience and I liked who I was working with very much, I'm not going to say I loved her, because to be honest, I always thought that talk therapy would be more charismatic.
What, you expected your therapist to be more charismatic?
I expected them to say interesting things, to have interesting observations about the baggage I was bringing, and for us to have a good chin wag. And what I felt was that I was just kind of showing up, saying a bunch of shit, and then she barely even laughed. And
that was going to be another question. Like, did you try and make your therapist laugh?
Yeah. Did you?
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah.
And did she tell you at some point, like, you don't really have to be entertaining
you
here?
You don't really have to do that here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because there's another line in Scenes of a Graphic Nature, which I'm going to read now. And it's, the difference between a funny story and an upsetting memory is in how you shade it. And here the shading is just right. So, and the reason I, and so yes, do you always shade your stories to make them funny?
Yeah.
Even in therapy, even in a very specific circumstance where when I started going to therapy, one of the things that I noticed was this massive relief that I don't have to worry about whether or not this person likes me, because I'm literally paying them to listen to me. So I don't have to worry about whether they're having a good time, whether they're listening or not, whether I'm being boring, whether I need to show up for them or support them in any way, because I just don't have to think about that anymore. So I found that a massive relief.
I never got there.
Oh.
And I think that's why therapy never worked for me. And maybe it would have if I kept doing it. I think I'm not somebody who can do talk therapy, actually.
Mm.
Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'll try it again at some point when I'm having another episode and I'll love it and I'll try somebody different and we'll click. But for me, I think, because a big part of my, my entire job is expressing myself, and it has been for a really long time.
Mm.
And I can convince myself of anything. I can talk myself into or out of anything. And so me just sat in a couch in a, you know, anonymous therapist office, I can just like talk myself up, talk myself down. And if I think I'm a better talker than the person who's opposite me, I'll effectively dismiss whatever they have to say. And I don't like that about myself, but it's nonetheless true. But then I've had this, and this is like, I'm sure you probably had this on the podcast already, and it's like probably, I don't really know enough about mental health communities to know whether this is a massive faux pas, but it feels like one.
Fantastic. Those are my favorite things, by the way. Mental health faux pas. Love it.
But I felt like I have gotten much more therapeutic effects out of things that don't engage those parts of my mind that are already developed.
Okay. Can you give me an example?
So my most recent example is tennis.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, it is tennis. So I was like a very, very unsporty and uncoordinated kid. And I'm still quite an unsporty and uncoordinated adult. But I always had this sort of thing in my head, because my parents both play it. And my grandmother was like semi-pro, which was like kind of like amazing.
That's
like
huge.
Really cool. There's like these beautiful photographs hanging on our wall at home of her at like junior Wimbledon, like literally in the 20s, like, you know, her hair all set and everything, the heavy wooden racket.
Oh,
and I've always felt like, wow, that's amazing. Mm. Like, and I can't, well, I'm going to be the first person in my family in like literally 100 years to not play. Like, no. And so I started playing about 12 weeks ago. And I was so bad, so very bad. Mm. But everything that happened when I played with my, because it's like a group thing, we meet every Saturday with the coach. I realized that I'm in so rarely, because I've built this life for myself where I get to do what I'm good at, and I get to hang out with who I like. But I have built this life for myself where embarrassment or feeling vulnerable are actually quite rare feelings. And so I go to that course with that team of people who are also learning, and we're all extremely vulnerable. And my body does things, and I can't argue or joke with it. I remember I started with doing that thing of like, oh, there's me being crap again. And everyone gets really exhausted by that really quickly. Mm. And so you kind of, that power gets taken away from you. It doesn't matter how funny you are about being crap, you're still annoying everybody about being crap. So you just kind of shut up. And then I was just kind of playing and getting into it. And I remember my teacher or my coach, she put her hand on my shoulder and she said, you know, Caroline, you always have more time than you think. And I just wanted to cry because it was like, because first of all, the class itself put me in this really vulnerable place to hear something like that. And then I was like, that's my whole problem, my whole life. You know, I'm just a dog chasing after cars all the time. And I make it look like productivity, but it is just, you know, that dog on your street where a van goes down and goes,
danger, danger, danger.
Yeah, yeah, that's it. And I was like, fuck.
Oh my goodness.
Fuck, Mrs. Tennis. This is a big moment for me and you don't even know.
Wow, that's amazing. Because I thought you were going to talk about the physical benefits of exercise, of which there are many. But
oh yeah, sure.
But now that's a completely different bit of your brain, isn't it? If you're not exercising or practicing vulnerability or even being around people who aren't necessarily always going to agree with you, and yeah, if they're going to like push or you,
and you have nothing in common with as well. Mm. The only thing I have in common with these people that I play with every Saturday is that we all live in the same part of Southeast London and we all want to learn tennis. And it's like every different sort of ages, nationalities, this mental cross section. The small talk is appalling.
So ready for more tennis?
Well, yeah, actually, it's very bad.
Are you gonna,
how about that Serena Williams?
I'm gonna today I think I'm gonna try and hit the ball.
Yeah, you?
You? Any tips?
What's your plan?
Do people ask you whether writing is therapy, and what is your response when people say writing must be so therapeutic?
Not that often, I don't think, but I don't think anyone's ever said that to me, but I do find it very therapeutic. I don't know why is that. I do think that, like, I do work out. I am somebody who, I'm generally the last person to know when I'm depressed, I think. Mm. Because I think I always compare this to my best friend Ella Risbridger, who she wrote Midnight Chicken, which had a lot of mental health issues in it, and she writes about this stuff very fluidly and very fluently. And she is somebody who's so good at just talking, like processing her emotions as she's having them, and she's able to find the words for them as she's speaking, and she's assembling this like masterpiece of feeling in front of me. And I just, and when she does that, I act like I'm her husband. I just like look at the ground. I'm like, because like I think I when it comes to like under the surface real sediment stuff, it takes me a really long time to enunciate that kind of thing. But for some reason, when I'm writing it through characters, it feels very clear and very easy, because I think it's that distance. You
yeah.
know? So I do find it therapeutic, and I do find that like when I look back on something, especially if it's a thing of like you write a novel and then you send it to your publishers, and then a few months later you do an editor, you edit it, you're able to see as easy as 3 months ago what was really bothering you. Mm. And that's I think it's lovely as a sort of living document, you know?
It's a really, really valuable tool, I think, for working out, like you say, over a period of weeks and months even, working out what's important to you. Do you do morning pages?
No.
No.
Do you?
I try to. I do try to, and I do feel better when I do.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't know. Because like, the whole thing with morning pages, isn't it, is that you're sort of... You're not writing with a task in mind. You're just kind of flowing and whatever comes, which is very lovely. But I don't know. I think I'm too maybe task oriented. I don't know. It's never worked for me, I guess. I would just always.
It's like the thing with your, it's like the dream journal, isn't it? It's like the thing with your therapist going, but I want it to be pretty. But I want it to,
I want it to be good and marketable.
And marketable, exactly.
Yeah. Because the thing is, I mean, I don't know when you, sat down to write your book, which I started reading today, and is so lovely and so much fun and so wonderful and full of heart and spirit and verve. You do feel like it's someone writing very easily, but at what point in writing that, or did you know from immediately that you're like, oh, this is going to be a commercial viable product that will have an Amazon rating one day?
No, it's my first book. So I don't know whether I didn't have that head on at all. Yeah. And especially because
did you think you were doing?
And well, the thing is, so I was offered a contract for the book deal, and then the contract didn't actually get signed for another year. There was like this massive like ice age of stillness in between. And, in that year, I didn't do any work. So I'd written the 30,000 word proposal. And in that year, I didn't touch it because I was too scared. I didn't want to jinx it. And then when they signed the contract, they went, okay, can you deliver it in 3 months? And I went, yeah. Ooh. And I did. And I was working full time and I wrote in the morning and I wrote in the evening. And what that did was, I wasn't able to second guess what was going to go in the book. I wasn't able to go, what if my mum reads that? What if my dad reads that? What does this make me unemployable? Well, who's going to think of X, Y, and Z? It all just had to go in.
Yeah.
So it is very, there is a sense of urgency in it, I think. But God, no, I didn't have a clue. I really admire that. How do you make something? How do you aim to have a 4.2 Amazon rating? I'd love to be able to think like that. But
I think it's so weird because like I always think of that like that Dolly Parton saying where it's like take your broken heart and make it into art and then they'll put it on Goodreads and give it a score out of 5.
Oh Dolly. She's so wise.
It's such a weird thing that we've like It's so odd to me that every writer's generation before ours, their only real knowledge of whether something was selling or not was just like an annual or a biannual notification from their publisher, you know, or whether or not they got a follow-up deal, you know. It's crazy that we now have to know all these stats about ourselves and probably not good for our mental health.
No. How does that... like when the so you've got a book that's just come out, All Our Hidden Gifts. So that came out in February of this year.
But it was delayed because of the pandemic.
Because of the old Big Ron spoils the party again.
Exactly. Big Ronnie. Purple Ronnie. So it was delayed until May. So it actually hasn't been out very long at all. It's now July.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So if there's a big moment like that, if there's a big thing coming up that you know is going to have, it's going to be stressful. It might be brilliant. You've got no idea. What steps do you put in place to look after your mental health? Or do you, or do you not?
I do, and it is a really good question because I think what's so interesting, and people talk to you, when you have had a few books out and when you're doing it as a career, people do ask you a lot about it because it is a thing lots of people want to do, and I understand that because I think novel writing is the most democratic of all the art forms in that there are very few gatekeepers except for the publisher. it's not like when you want to make movies and there are so many people you have to get on board. And so there is something so romantic about the idea that you could just be sitting in your bedroom typing for 6 months, and then a year later it would be on the shelves in a Waterstones. And I think people have this real misconception that as soon as you see it in a Waterstones, you will feel complete and you'll feel like your time on this earth was kind of for something because you're in a book, and that's what everyone dreams about, right? Of going into a shop and seeing the thing and pulling it out. But my experience of it is that I love writing. I quite like editing. I quite like pitching. I really like meeting readers. I really like doing events. I really like doing podcasts. But the actual bit where the book is coming out into shops, I think, is hell. And I find it really difficult. And I'm yet to meet an author who doesn't find it extremely difficult. For a number of reasons. I don't know, is this your experience?
I had so in BC I had an actual book launch, and I was quite stressed about it because I didn't know what that meant. I was like, are there going to be journalists? Yeah. Are going to be people judging me? And my lovely agent Sophie just went, it's just a party, just bring some nice pictures, like get your mates and your family around and just have a nice time. And I was like, oh right, okay, I'll just do that. But I had no idea, like, of the impact of, not that it's like the Bible, I had no idea of my influence.
Yeah.
But seeing it in like the W.H. Smith at Victoria train station, that was really, it was all just nice. But I was very aware of the first couple of weeks, I was just constantly refreshing the Amazon page just to see what could happen, what might happen, where it might be, what could and there's no sort of, there's no kind of fact sheet or a worksheet to go, these are the steps, this is what will happen next.
There's really, it's so interesting. I am really amazed that publishers don't provide that information and that you really have to learn that off of other authors. Mm. And lots of people, you know, they don't live in London, they don't have media connections like I was lucky enough to have. They don't have other authors. Sometimes they're the only person they know going through this. Mm. And they have, even though it's this wonderful thing to happen to you, they have no idea how disassociative it can be, how you have this sense coming up to it as well, especially as reviews from, like, first of all, you know, the media itself, from either magazines or newspapers, if you're even lucky enough to get reviewed. And that's something else you have to worry about, is where, like, because you always assume, oh, I'm writing a book, it will get reviewed. But actually they have to, the book pages are diminishing. They have to decide whether or not you are good enough to review. Mm. And then they have to decide whether you're good enough to give a good review. Mm. So that's really taxing on a person who's not running a business, but it's just themselves. And then there's blogger reviews, and you don't know how many of them they're going to be. It could be 12, it could be 100, and you're like, who is this random woman in Idaho who likes me but who can't spell? And you're like, okay, but, and then you have this kind of expanding sense of your own, like, wow, it's so cool that my book is in Idaho, but also what does it mean that my book is in Idaho? and so that kind of does a weird thing to your brain. And then often you get a sense from people you know that they're waiting for you to get too big for your boots, and they're waiting to check you. I hear this a lot from Irish authors and from Northern authors. There's like a tallest poppy syndrome people are waiting for. Do you have that experience at all?
Oh yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I also think I'm sort of, I have the benefit of being quite a late bloomer. And when I didn't move to London, I moved to London when I was 26, and I'd gone to university in Preston, the jewel of the north. And lovely. I managed to get a job. It was like a bursary funded thing with an opera company. They just gave bursaries to these arts companies to help graduates get into the arts. Mm. And I got this 15 grand a year bursary to work full time for an opera company. And it was there, but I was working alongside and with people who'd been to Oxford and Cambridge and Goldsmiths.
Yeah. Wow.
But in my head, I was like, well, you're no better than me. If you were that much better than me, we wouldn't be doing the same job.
Yeah.
So that in a really twisted way, that sort of, I have no chippiness whatsoever, but I also notice when other people are uncomfortable about their status around me.
Which
I find interesting.
It is interesting how people's attitudes towards you can shift. Because like we all it's funny because and this is going to sound very my diamond shoes are too tight, and I really don't want it to sound this way, but we all talk a lot about sort of Instagram comparison culture and how negative it is for your mental health, and people always center very myopically that feeling on themselves, on like, here are all the beautiful women or the successful women that I see that make me feel bad. But you never think about how that's also you for other people.
Yeah.
and if you're somebody who's got a few books on the go and someone who's presenting their life in such a way, which I know I'm guilty of, people will change their reactions to you. And this is something that actually Dolly said to me, Dolly Alderton, not Dolly Parton, although their wisdom is on a par, because she is somebody who obviously has huge success and it's been wonderful for her, but she also has to deal with that pendulum swing of people changing their expectations of you. And she says, she said to me, people will always think that fame is something that happens to you, but it's actually something that happens around you. And so people in your life think, or people not even in your life, but like friends of friends of friends, think that some wonderful disease has infected you and changed the sort of molecular stability of who you are and has changed you and your outlook. But actually, it's just this cloud of vapor around you that's making you harder to see, and it can be really frustrating. Like I had dinner with somebody, like a really dear friend, last week. We've been friends for 10 years, we're both busy, and he's moved out of London, so we don't see each other as much as we want to. And he made just that a third or fourth crack that was like, oh, the famous novelist doesn't have time to see her friends. And I was like, no, we both couldn't make this lunch happen for a while, and you're just making this about like your feelings about what I do for a living.
And what happened there?
No, we're like very good friends. So he was like, okay, fair enough, I'll stop.
Yeah, okay, good.
Sorry, I feel like I'm being very this is therapy again. Oh no.
You're welcome. So if you are approaching a busy period like that, or like a stressful or a weird or even a situation that not many people can relate to, it's quite an alien thing, and it's quite it's quite lonely, right? Because you've made this thing by yourself. You're the author of it. You haven't made it by yourself. Publishers, printers, PR people, etc.
Yeah, there's a big team, but ultimately, if it sucks or if there's something objectionable in it, and I think increasingly creators of all fields are like, oh, what if I'm accidentally Louis C.K. or something?
Yeah.
And everyone's going to be able to tell.
I don't think I'm a sexual assailant, but maybe, I don't know.
Maybe I am.
I think, I mean, just on that, there are so many, I did it in my book as well. I think we kind of, authors and writers and creators in general do tend to kind of trip over ourselves to put in so many caveats before you actually see the thing, to go, this is just my experience. My experience. And
I can completely see it. If you've written a book that's non-fiction and partly memoir and about mental illness, the sort of temptation to couch everything you say in like disclaimers or whatever.
Yeah.
I can imagine it's very tempting, because you're already imagining like a snooty Guardian review that's a bit like, ooh, Michelle thinks that just because she had a panic attack and vomited off the Eiffel Tower that everybody does this.
You have read the book. Yeah, it is that, but it's also the like the terrible fear of like misrepresenting other people or misrepresenting a particular thing or being and that was really that's really stressful. So what do you do when you've got this like mad thing coming up? What does self-care look like to Caroline O'Donoghue?
Thank you for bringing us back to that, because I'm aware now that you asked that about 10 minutes ago.
All right, I love it.
Telling you about how terrible it is to be a novelist and have all your dreams come true. my first two books that came out, even though I enjoyed writing them and I loved the team I made them with, I really didn't enjoy those sort of 2 weeks when it came out.
Mm.
And when the third one came out, All Our Hidden Gifts, I was very, very careful. I was like, like 3 weeks coming up to the launch, I had said to my boyfriend, I was like, you know, I was trying to make sure that I was communicating a lot in a way that I hadn't before.
Mm.
And just kind of, you know, coming into his office and just being a bit like, as in his home office, I wasn't like walking into his work.
Kicking the door down. The famous novelist is here to bust up a meeting with the clients and the account manager.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, you were there.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was just like, look, just so you know, I'm going to be a bit weird the next few weeks, and this is what it might look like. And please just be a mensch and let me be mental. And he was like, fine. And I also, on the sort of week it was coming up, I made sure that I don't generally work to-do list, because generally, you know, I'm working on several projects at once and, you know, an email pops through, I'll open that, I'll go away, I'll have a sandwich, I'll look on Twitter, I'll work on something else. I'm generally very free-floating, the same way as everybody works. But on those days that were coming up to this period, I made sure that I had like a very distinct to-do list that was very itemized, whether it was like file column, record video for German publisher, or you know, write 200 words or whatever for so-and-so.
Mm-hmm.
I had this list, and as soon as that list was done, I just closed the laptop and went into the garden, or I walked the dog, and I just made sure that I wasn't spending any time connected to the mainframe that I needed, that was absolutely necessary. And on the day of my launch, my friend Jen Cowney, so the book is about tarot, or there's a very strong tarot storytelling element in it. Mm. And my friend Jen Cowney is a professional tarot card reader. And she, with the publishers, they paid her to do some tarot card readings on Zoom with like bloggers and teenagers and that kind of thing, which is very cute.
Amazing.
But on that day, she came over here and she was in my room, and I was out in the garden the whole day. And like every half an hour, she would say, Caroline, there's a 14-year-old in like Berlin who wants to meet you. And I came in and I said hello to the 14-year-old in Berlin. And then I walked back out of it. I was like, oh, what a perfect day. And that was it, you know? And that was like, oh my God, I've never felt more stable at the end of a launch day, you know?
Amazing. Did you get your cards read?
By Jen? Yeah, she reads them a lot. Yeah, yeah.
How was it?
I read tarot a lot anyway. So it's kind of quite a frequent thing in my life.
Mm.
Yeah, it's all. Do you use them at all?
I do. I love. I've read them since I was about 15, and for me, mm-hmm. like there's nothing mystical or mythical about them.
Yeah.
I think it just offers you a new perspective and a new way of looking at things.
Yeah.
In I don't know if you've ever worked in advertising or in marketing, but there's this.
Yes.
So the Edward de Bono thing, right, with the six hats. So mm-hmm. there's six different colored hats, and but you wear the green one and you've got to look at a product through a particular viewpoint, and the red one and this, that, and the other. And I just think the six hats, and this is invented by a dude and it's absolutely like lauded and celebrated and it's brilliant. Mm. And it's seen as a legitimate tool for creativity. And it's a legitimate way to exercise your brain in a different way. Whereas something like tarot or runes, things that are traditionally and historically used by women, It's all just...
You're so speaking my language.
It's
here.
All really just... Are. Oh, it's all just frippery and ladiness. Yeah. And it's made of periods. And it's just
made of periods.
Made of periods. Yeah. But I...
No, you're so right. This is it. Like, this is it. It's oh, my God. There are so many of these, like, business-approved, hyper-masculine... like, I've never heard of that red hat, yellow hat thing, but I've done... I worked in advertising as well, so I've done versions of that where like somebody who's being paid like $5,000 a day came in to speak to us and like, oh, you're more of a politician and you're more of a
you're whatever. The fucking the Myers-Briggs stuff.
Yeah, all that shit. Oh, and it's all just these like these ways of taxonomizing that already exist and are in the tarot, which has been around since the 15th fucking century. Mm. But no one's going to bring that into a boardroom unless it's like Cookie Lady Day for International Women's Month, you know?
Yeah.
It's so annoying.
I hate it. there's an episode of the podcast actually with a lady. She's a witch. She's based in LA, called Marcella Kroll, and she she's incredible. She does tarot and she's amazing, and she talks about how because I was thinking about whether or not we need spirituality, because that's something that's not really present in my life, just because I'm not particularly religious. And I was like, okay, but if I'm gonna like engage with a particular spirituality, like witchcraft, that was like nature healing, just do a bit of that. So I spoke to her about it, and it was really interesting about her relationship between spirituality and her mental health. So do you is tarot one of the tools that you use to manage your mental health?
I think that's like everything you said there really chimed with me, because I do think that you're like, if I feel the exact same way. If I was raised Roman Catholic, but I don't, even though I feel like culturally of that religion, obviously there's very little left that isn't appalling in there. So that's something. And I was like, okay, yeah, like witchcraft and Wicca has so much like. Basically, it's like it's completely depatriarchal. It's totally matriarchal.
Totally matriarchal, yeah.
Yeah, not just in the sense that it's mostly women, but also in the sense that there's no pyramid scheme. There's no structure. It's just like women all over the world since the beginning of time making the best with what they have and doing their best by the planet. And it's like, what about that isn't fucking ideal? come on. But then whenever I love writing about magic, I love researching it. Like my young adult series is all about that. And I love tarot, and I do find tarot extremely useful for like parsing my own thoughts and giving my feelings visual aids, really.
Absolutely
helpful. And even though I love the research, I love writing about it, it's like I can't quite connect on my heart level with it in terms of like, this is something I'm going to practice for me right now, which makes me feel like kind of a fraud, but I don't know. I think it might come. I think maybe the reason I read so much and write so much about it is because I'm sort of like building a nest for later, maybe when I'm not this like incredibly busy lady in London just trying to chase after cars. Maybe there will come a moment where I can really just fucking commune with this shit, you know?
You've always got more time, Caroline.
Yeah, you've always got more time.
You've always got more time, mate.
Yeah.
Okay, so Caroline Donahue, what advice would you give to someone who like yourself, you started going to see a therapist because you wanted some help to process your grief, and over the last 18 months I feel like there are going to be so many more people who are occupying that space and who need to work through those feelings. Is there any advice that you can give to those people, or if one of those people was sat in front of you, what would you say to them?
It's such a a huge question, because we haven't actually talked about that grief thing at all. So
there hasn't been time.
So, and I haven't thought about that in a while, but it's such a good question. And I do think that it sounds a little bit woo, but having an active and ongoing relationship with the person that has died, I think is really important. Because the person, so my grandfather died, which, like, when you say grandfather died, it's a bit like, oh yeah, well, you were set up, you knew that was going to happen. That's in the, you know, that's in the spark notes. Like, we all know our grandparents are going to die. But he was like a real, like, head of the family in a way that almost feels like quite traditional and like something from 100 years ago. Mm. Like, he was really the person who, like, because we're this like very traditional family, but because he was just an incredible person. Like, he was like a massive feminist. He was like born in 1912, but like he was really, really progressive and really charitable and really funny. And so I think when he died, that destabilized us all in terms of like, where's the heart now, you know?
Mm.
And so that was one thing. And then about 2 months later, one of my best friends died. And his name was John. And they were both called John, actually. So I remember that whole year, I was like, I'm out of Johns. All my Johns are dead. and obviously, John, the second John, was very young, but he had been ill for a long time and all that. And I was with neither of them in their final days for different reasons. I think friends are rarely there in the final days anyway, right? Because of that time traditionally belongs to blood family. And because I had missed what I saw as those fundamental moments of like saying goodbye and all that kind of stuff, it really did feel like not just the guilty thing of not being there for the person in their time of need, but also that sense of a conversation going unfinished.
Mm.
Of like, and this is something I thought about a lot in the last 18 months during COVID, particularly friends who don't live in London. And I say this a lot to them. And I say, like, if I knew the last time I saw you was the last time I was going to see you for 2 years, I think my heart would have snapped in two. I think the ground beneath me would have separated and I would have been sucked into the earth with my own sorrow. Because like, imagine if someone told me when I was hugging you goodbye at a party, I wouldn't see you for 2 years. You know, it's like, that ruins me. And I feel the same way about my Johns, you know, like when I look at like DMs on Twitter that we sent each other and I'm like, how, imagine if I had known. And so that, I think for me, I find very hard to process. But then I think working on having an ongoing relationship with those people in your head, and I think that's what many religious people do through prayer, is probably how they do that. But I think what I found helpful, like John is dead, but John is my friend. Do you know what I mean? It's not John was my friend, John is my friend. And even though I don't really believe in an afterlife in the traditional sense, things like that did help. And like talking about not just his noble traits, but his annoying traits helped. Mm. And having, you know, and I was lucky because I have such a tight group of friends, and we were all processing it together. But yeah, I do think, I don't know, it doesn't really strike me as advice, but yeah, it was helpful to me. Yeah. Mm.
Do you, this might be odd, do you talk to John in your head?
No, not anymore. There was a time when I did. Mm. And then this is going to sound, sorry, I should stop couching. If a therapist was here, she would say I am couching a lot. But I remember I thought a lot about him and to him and that kind of thing. And then I remember we'd had this amazing day. Sorry. We'd had this amazing day very shortly after we'd first met, and he was my first friend that I made when I moved to London, and I didn't know anybody at all. And he was just extremely kind. And he was the only person in that office I was working at who recognized, like, oh, that Irish girl doesn't have anywhere to go at the weekend. so I'm going to take her to things. And that was really beautiful and such a kindness you can do to anyone in that situation. But we had this really magic day where we'd gone, because he worked as a film critic, and we'd gone to see a film screening. And he was someone who was a very old-fashioned person. And so he said, oh, you know, let me take you to my club, because he'd gotten this sort of, you know how they're like, oh, people under 30 can have this cheap club membership if they come between Wednesday, between 7 and 8. He had one of those.
Oh, brilliant.
You know, the very London thing.
Yeah.
So he took me to his members only club, and we had like just a bunch of whiskeys and all these sort of the stars of the film we had just seen, because we'd gone to like a premiere screening, came into there, and then we were like just eating loads of like mini plates and drinking with the whiskey and being like, that's the guy from the film. And it was just really magic. And then I had this really, about 6 months after he died, I had this really vivid dream where we were at that, in that club again, and we were eating all the little bits of ham and we were drinking the whiskey cocktails, and I think we talked, and I'm pretty sure I wrote down what we said somewhere, but I can't really recall now. So I think if I tried to recall, I would just invent it. But there was a sense of closure, and even though it was a dream, I just felt, I was like very grateful to myself for giving me what I needed, you know. And I really needed it, and it really meant something, and it still means something to me.
Thank you so much.
No, I can't, but I've never talked about that before.
That's beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for asking, actually. And I think if anyone's listening and they have a friend who's grieving, asking not just how are you or what was he like, but like specific questions about the person that died. There's nothing I like more than someone asking me a specific question about John or about my granddad John, and then me having to unearth a memory that I've never thought about before. Mm. And then it's like this little gift I get to have with myself, and it's like, what? Yay. Yeah, I think there's so much of a temptation with grief, especially among young people, to just move on to the next thing as quickly as possible, because you think you're sparing the person pain, but actually you're just cushioning yourself from their emotions, you know? And yeah, so I wish people would do that more.
You can follow Caroline on Twitter at Kazaroline. It's Caroline with a Z after the C. It's another sneaky writer's trick. You can follow me at Michelle Thomas, or you can get in touch with me at myshittherapist@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening. Don't forget to share and pop in a little review if you can. 5 stars, thank you. And in the meantime, until next time, take care and take your meds. Bye!